you're going to be a, I guess, a income blocker.
Yes.
Right? And so it's just
Jacek. Right. So I would like to first of all thank you very much. Thank you very much for possibility to give a talk on this session. This is I will present you a result that is presented that was published very very recently in on archive. And well, this is a. I was trying to bite the problem of well, a bit of the normalization of spin foam edge amplitude, and well, let me show you the plan of the talk. First, I will show where does this operator of which I call Lorentzian polyhedral propagator come from. This will be motivation. And then define it and show some. How do I investigate it? And what are problems related to it? Then, well, I will show you some calculations and the results. So, first, my first motivation to investigate the problem was the dipole cosmology. And in the dipole cosmology model, we have a transition amplitude which is given by this formula, and now. Look at this this part here. This part here, well, we can look at it as a matrix element of a certain operator T. I call this operator polyhedral propagator. We'll see in a second why. And well, it wasn't studied by in the Lorentzian case. It wasn't studied by no one yet. And now those of you who was on Aldo Zielo's talk also know the problem of bubble divergence in the spin foam edge propagator. Now, if we consider a spin foam with an edge, the splits then goes back. Well, it's in terms of operators. Spin network diagrams, which was introduced by me and Professor Lewandowski some time ago, it's represented by such diagram. This represents the structure of the vertex here. So there is an edge. There are several faces around it. Here, these links represent the faces inside the bubble. They are linked together. And then glue together and go back. So, well, if you assume that the maximum spin on the faces inside is lambda, then Aldo Zielo calculated and published his result that that the amplitude is given by such a formula. Now, again, I don't care much about this part of the calculation which gives this term here. I'm interested in this object, which is in fact the same operator T squared, and well, Aldo showed that it is that in some case you can show this divergence to be logarithmic in lambda, which is nice because then we would well, logarithm is some nice divergence. We can so we should study this operator to see what is it. This is logarithm times something. So what is this something? So I define an operator Lorentzian polyhedral propagator, which is, well, by the formula given by this. In terms of spin foams, you can think of it as a single vertex on an edge. It doesn't have to be four-valent edge, it may be any kind of edge. Well, in terms of diagrams, it's, again, it's just a theta graph. And now, the Aldo result can be represented as well as, instead of this bubble, we have just two vertices on the edge. Times logarithm, right? So now what? Then we should check what happens in this vertex. Well, few technical details. We can study it. We can study it thanks to harmonic analysis on the SL2C group. We can express these matrix elements in terms of this representations of SL2C group. they are some hypergeometric functions. They are quite hard to integrate, but well, we can do it. We can do it. Why? We can do it because we are in the enlarged spin limit. So let's J be the maximum spin of the external faces of this edge. Then well, everything scales with J, and every term here scales somehow with J. So we can use the saddle point approximation and say that the leading order will be, well, a function of J times some terms calculated at unity. So, well, at unity, everything is easy to calculate. Now, it's not so obvious because our function must satisfy some assumptions, and, well, no one ever checks if it satisfies, so I needed to check. First of all, to integrate it, it's good to notice that everything is very, very, very symmetric. This integrand we have, is SU2 invariant tensor times this times SU2 invariant tensor. Now this group element, well, can be decomposed into group directions can be decomposed into rotations and boosts, and now, well, everything is invariant under rotations, right? The rotations go skip over the APRL map and then kill this the sensor. So well, then our integral is not integral over SL2C, but only over a boost, over the boosts, right? And it's even better because a boost can be represented as a Z boost times some rotations, right? So again, we have some rotations. They skip the Y map, then they doesn't do a thing. And in fact, what we need to integrate is a function of only one parameter, a complicated function, but only one parameter, right? So so we end up with an integral of just one parameter, just the length of the boost-dependent function. Now, this function also vanishes quite quickly, what I showed. One can prove that this few slides before I showed that there are terms like F, J, M here. One can show that each of these terms is, well, bound by such a term. They are even lower, but this is enough to show that all the function is exponentially decreasing in eta and j. So it's obvious, it's almost obvious that the result will be dependent only on the behavior close to the unity. Right now. So let's investigate our function in the unity element. The first derivative of the exponent is such a formula. The second, the Hessian matrix, is such a formula. We need them in the saddle point theorem, and they don't look nice. But well, we can again use the gauge invariance, the SU2 gauge invariance of the matrix element, which sandwich those functions, right? We have iota here, iota prime here, and this will simplify things a lot. Why? First, well, the total magnetic momentum number must be zero. So here this term vanish. Everything is decreasing firstly with iota, so in the last j with j, so in the last j limit, first derivative vanish, which is good. There is a saddle point. Now, what happens with the square magnetic number? Well, there was a lemma. I haven't found it elsewhere, so I will just show you it briefly. If we have an object like this, gauge invariant tensor, and magnetic momentum square, well, it's a matrix element of such an operator, but thanks to rotation invariance, it's also, it doesn't matter if it's LZ or LX or LY, so it's one third of sum of it. Sum of it, but sum of it is, gives a simple simple eigenvalue, so in fact, this sum is equal to this. And well, if we have a polynomial of mi squared, right? Here it's not mi squared, but a polynomial, then we can do the same. We can put a basis, orthonormal basis between each LZ squared, and well, obtain squared total magnetic total spin, total spin, its eigenvalue. So we have a so we have a function of a total spin, and well, it's in, if it works for polynomial, then for convergent series it will also work the same. That's why here we don't need to bother ourselves with these coefficients. We just can substitute this m squared by j by something j dependent, and it simplifies a lot to such a number. Now, what is the xi? I haven't told you what are xi's. If we have a I know, and I'm heading to the end. Now, in our these xi's are parameters from 0 to 1. In each vertex there is number of spins j1, j2, jn. The maximum of them I call the capital J, and xi's are ratios. So they are number from 0 to 1. They are not the I can't tell that they are little numbers. They are they're not negligible. But well, this is a definitely shape-dependent term. Now let's go to the results. First, the result is that the operator has its former the leading order is proportional to the unity. Because because of this form of integrals calculated at the unity operator, and the representations in unity is in unity, and this is just a proportionality factor. This factor, it's quite interesting because well, it's the total area of a polyhedron, total area of the polyhedron that we obtained by the Minkowski theorem applied to the node of a spin network. Right, times some alpha. Now, what is this alpha? This alpha, well, it's a number. I can calculate it's something about half, right? Another term here is this alpha of xi, which scales, which does depend on the shape, but not on the size. It scales with the size of our polyhedron. There are some bounds on it. So, for example, for a tetrahedron, its bounded is from 1/4 to 1/3. It doesn't vary a lot. Another result I don't have time to speak of more. But what are the results from this? What are the implications, for example, in dipole cosmology? Well, in dipole cosmology, the transition amplitudes that we had, well, something changes in it. In fact, this factor here changes into a factor which is shape dependent. So the minor result doesn't change because the exponential dependency of a phase space point, which is here, is not influenced by this. And this factor, well, it varies again from 1 to 3. So it's not a big change for a qualitative result, but well, it's good to know it. Another thing, let's look at this bubble divergence which Aldo calculated. So he calculated that this transition amplitude of such an edge is logarithms time t squared. So I got that it's a number times unity, and this is the number. The logarithms over j to cube times a factor, and if you study this factor, then if we put a cutoff on the maximum spin 10 to the 120, which is enormous number, then this all the factor is less than 10. So it's a nice small number. Now, one last thing is the denormalization, because it inspired me to consider a series of edges which will increase in number of vertices. Well, it should sum up to 1 over 1 minus t, right? Since t is unity, it's just a factor times the unity, and this factor, well, this factor is almost 1. That almost nothing changed. Well, it's the factor, first of all, always converged, then it's almost 1. And what about the bubbles? If we sum the series of bubbles, then we have again 1 over 1 minus factor. And this factor, well, it's not, A is not bigger, is not always less than 1, but for a, but it's 10 over j cube. So for spins bigger than 2, it is already less than 1. So the sum converges, and well, for j less than 2, well, my approximation doesn't work. One cannot do this all these expansions I did. So let me summarize. There is an operator which I studied. It behaves quite well. It's proportional to the identity. I studied its applications, including the normalizations. And well, there are many things which one can study more. For example, supleading order, or understand what is this factor, because it's, if you look closer on it, well, this is something like the ratio of the area to volume, which well maybe is related to some curvature. So thank you all for your attention, and sorry for being a little bit too long. Well, everything is clear.
All right, so it was clear. All right, so let's thank that side again. Thank you.
So thanks, Florian, for inviting me to his session. Also, I didn't give him a talk in my session, so it's pretty nice for him. And yeah, I will try to convey an idea how to solve your theory. So we had several theories, or one depending on your opinion, presented in this conference. You know, somebody gives you a theory and says this is a theory of quantum gravity, and you happen to be a PhD student and now have to figure out what do you do with this theory. And sometimes it comes in these forms of, this is a fundamental building block and I have an amplitude for this building block, and now do something with it. And yes, the first thing is basically, what do you want to do with that, and how do we describe a background independent theory, and what do we consider as the solutions? And one way to describe your theory is via Robert's, this one, generalized boundary formalism. So basically the idea is, okay, you are in quantum gravity, you don't really have access to any background, so what you have given is a certain region, and not even this region, you just have the boundary. And the boundary comes with some geometric data in the form of a boundary wave function. And what you have to define, or what we have to find, is for given boundary wave function, the amplitude that you can, you know, either consider as a function of this boundary or of the space-time region. Typically, actually, this is an idea which comes from quantum field theory and measure theory. You use test states for your boundary states, which carry, in a certain sense, a finite amount of information, for instance, supported on a graph and so on, which some people might know, and in loop quantum gravity, this is basically the standard tool, which is used to describe this is you know, the continuum theory, but with certain discrete features. Okay. So, you know, so using your favorite theory of quantum gravity, how do you get this amplitude map? And basically, all these formalism in quantum gravity is very nice. In principle, you could think you just glue lots of regions together with a given fundamental amplitude map and hope to get some answer by basically using a form of regularized path integral. Of course, then you have to worry, you know, you can regularize it in different ways or use different discretizations. So you want to actually get rid of this dependence on the discretization. One way how you can hope to achieve it is to take the refinement limit to lose the dependence on the auxiliary discretization. So you have to hope that details of this limit at some point do not matter. And basically the question whether you take a regular refinement or something very irregular. One feature which you will notice here is that if you have a given boundary discreteness, you know, then it's kind of hard to refine arbitrarily close to the boundary. So you might already try, you know, get an idea that it's important to refine also the boundary at some point. Okay, so this was possibility A. If you change rooms, you will find, oh no, you should find sum over all kinds of discretizations. That is kind of a version of group field theory, depending on how you define the sum. And in principle, this might be, you know, equivalent at some point. But again, if you actually, what we are going to do is to define all these things with some requirements, and indeed, then there might be not so many possibilities at which end result you get or arrive. A third possibility is that, oh, you change again rooms and you end up in the canonical session. And they say, oh, you can get actually this amplitude map by solving the Hamiltonian constraints. And you have just to be clever enough to solve this Hamiltonian constraints. And then there's a bit of subtlety because Hamiltonian constraints might change the discretization. And then you have to think what it means. And possibility is that you take the coefficient of this expansion of your solution, which you get over these graphs or over these discrete structures. But again, once you have that, there are certain arguments that you can hope that this is actually the same, or that actually A should provide you this solution to the Hamiltonian constraints. And yeah, there might be other possibilities and other rooms I haven't explored yet, because I'm mostly chairing. So you hope to get some way to get a well-defined amplitude map, you know, which gives you a certain number for all kinds of boundary states supported on all kinds of discretizations. And discretizations of the boundary. So you already got rid of discretizations of the bulk. Assume that. So is that sufficient? Are you happy? You might not be really happy because what typically occurs actually in quantum gravity is that you can have different discretizations, but they describe you equivalent boundary data. So this looks like a very refined state. You know, luckily I'm not a computer artist, as you can see. But it might describe you basically the same state as this state. And this is in loop quantum gravity, or in general, you can describe that by a mathematical formalism called projective or inductive limit, depending on what you're speaking about. And this works with embedding maps, which in this case embed the coarse Hilbert space into the Hilbert space, you know, on this refined boundary. So given a state here, you can embed it into this Hilbert space and get a state on this refined graph. So given an amplitude map, and with this actually I mean a family of amplitude maps which are labeled by B, you would now actually require that the answer does not change if you apply it to different discretizations describing, however, the same physical state. And this is just what is understood as cylindrical consistency for any kind of observer. So here I've written down this requirement formally. So this is just the pullback of the embedding gives you the same answer as just using this coarse discretization. And indeed, it just means that the amplitude does not depend on which graph discrete structure we represent boundary data. And since it does not depend on it, you can easily take the limit, the continuum limit, you know, and you say, ah, I have a continuum result. And of course, that's great because you would be sure making a very simple calculation, calculation on a certain coarse grain scale, that this should also hold on the continuum. Of course, you need to construct these things. So the question now is basically, how do we get such a map, a cylindrically consistent amplitude map? And the idea is to use basically this concept of cylindrical consistency in the construction of your refinement limit, actually. Now I spoke about these embedding maps, and there's a nice embedding map in loop quantum gravity on which all these constructions are based. But you can ask, what are convenient families of embedding maps which might be useful for the dynamics? And that's basically the new thing. So given the discretization, you might basically hope that gluing two building blocks, you know, along different boundaries, you get the same result. And that would be, again, very convenient for you, but it's completely hopeless to hope for that. So as you see, that is here, this inequality sign. So basically, here you integrate over much more degrees of freedom than here. So doing this calculation with two different discretization scale, you will get some different result because you include just, you know, different amount of fluctuations. However, what you can hope for is actually using your embedding map. You know, you glue along a coarse boundary here, but you glue in a certain way that you, in principle, integrate over these degrees of freedom, but then you use this embedding map to embed this state into this one on the left-hand side and this one on the right-hand side. And then you glue. And now you can formulate a requirement on the embedding map, and this requirement is that this, putting this truncation actually, because it defines your truncation, should minimize the difference between these two evaluations. So embedding maps, which are convenient for the dynamics, actually allow us to replace the gluing along very fine boundaries by gluing along coarser boundaries in this sense, and they define good truncations for your dynamics. And this, you know, gives you in principle how to pick your embedding map defined by the dynamics. Unfortunately, in loop quantum gravity, the embedding map is actually constructed due to requirements of how to best represent your observer algebra. And it corresponds to a kinematical vacuum describing completely degenerate geometry with vanishing volumes and areas. It gives you very convenient embedding map for certain things, but on the other hand, it basically defines you the theory as an expansion around the zero geometry. So if you want to get to something more complicated, it is very complicated. The nice thing, if you have a way to find these embedding maps, they allow you an effective way to find the refinement limit by coarse graining or renormalization. And this works as follows. Given your boundary state, you know, you embed it into a more complicated boundary state. You use your more complicated boundary state to evaluate a certain gluing of your fundamental amplitudes. This gives you a number. And basically, going from this step to this step, you get a number associated to this boundary state, which you call your effective amplitude. So this is an effective coarse-grained amplitude. And we can now iterate and find a fixed point. And the point is that you can do that on, you know, starting with a very small building block. And once it gives you some method to do a doable calculation, in a sense, and find already something which is a certain approximation to your continuum theory, which brings us, of course, to the next question. How do you find these embedding maps? And there might be more ingenious methods. So the method which comes basically, which evolved actually after a long time from the Wilsonian idea to White in the 80s and in condensed matter, is motivated by the transfer operator technique. And that works as follows. If you consider the transition amplitude between two states in a more normal sense of transition amplitudes, you can represent it as follows, that you basically glue lots of these amplitudes together. All these things, one slice defines you a transfer operator from one time to the next, and you can basically look, put a decomposition of unity here, and get this transfer operator, which typically the argument goes as that only the large eigenvalues in this transfer operator will dominate if you take lots of these time slices. So you truncate by restricting your sum here to a certain number of eigenvectors of this transfer operators with the largest eigenvalues in usually in modulus. I mean, usually you consider statistical physics and these are all positive anyway. but the usual problem is that, you know, the diagonalization of T is difficult if you consider something large. So what one typically does is kind of localizing this problem and diagonalizing only certain chunks of this transfer matrix. And again, that in principle, you know, defines your iteration procedure, which gives you this effective amplitude in this way. So I'm kind of short of time, but that just conveys the idea. Okay, you can do that for the Ising model, and you can get different embedding maps for different dynamics defined by the temperature of your Ising model. And in particular, if you do it along a phase transition, you get embedding maps which for a long range of scales look basically constant. That is the idea of a phase transition. And you get a scale-free dynamics, which is actually exactly what you want in your background independent theory, because it is supposed to be background scale-free. Another thing is that it actually builds up your physical vacuum, because in general you have this idea that, okay, the coarse-grained boundary data might describe your homogeneous geometry. And then these embedding maps tell you what is the most likely configuration of your fine-grained degrees of freedom, which gives you the vacuum fluctuation of your finer degrees. And actually, there are lots of examples. There's a huge literature in the condensed matter. And if you go back in time using our ingenious Pilser method, you see examples of this method which we apply to so-called analog spin forms, and should look at the talks of Sebastian and Mercedes. They haven't been there. So the summary is that these coarse graining methods, you know, what we basically did is defining a coarse graining methods, define an efficient way to solve the theory as a continuum theory. Also, we use lots of discrete methods. The way to understand the physical vacuum and your theory at different scales, which are defined dynamically in this case. And that renormalization in this case is just an effective way to organize or connect dynamics at different scales. Okay, thank you.
All right. Any questions? I have a question for you.
For me?
Yeah. Why didn't you invite Bianca to a session that's called Discrete Approaches, because in the end she took the continuum limit. So So that's really my question to Bianco. Do you really want to take the continuum? Is it important to you in this?
So here, I mean, you can do whatever you prefer to do, because I'm open to all suggestions. Here, the general idea is that the discreteness comes from the spectrum of your geometric operators. So in general, the conjecture is that at some point, this limit trivializes, because you scope scales which are, you know, smaller than the spectrum of your operator, and you reach a fixed point. So we still have to see that in action, but you know, that's what the conjecture is, and for that you can, it doesn't really matter whether you stop at some point or not, in this, I mean, in this conjecture.
Except you'd have, I mean, in the case of the easing model that you showed us, there you really get a scale invariant theory.
It's a fixed point, yeah.
It's a fixed point, whereas gravity is not a scale invariant theory. So
no, this is...
Is this because you...
This is with respect to the background scale anyway, so one should be a bit careful.
So the question, so my question is, how does the scale, the real physical scale, you're making the background scale go away. So where is the physical scale meant to come from?
So in this example, you always have a boundary which, you know, in the boundary state defines you the physical scale. So the boundary state gives you a geometry, and from that you could define your physical scale.
Okay.
Apart from, you know, the scale which is in the spectrum, in the gap of your volume operator or area operator.
I'd like to thank the organizers for allowing me to speak in this session. Today I'm going to tell you about some results from causal set quantum gravity. These are results in two-dimensional quantum gravity in the way that I will explain. I'll begin, because this is just the second talk on causal sets in this entire week, so the only other talk apart from phase this morning, I'll begin by reminding you of the basic causal set hypothesis. And then I'll describe this continuum-inspired dynamics that one has and one can construct, and then describe these results in two-dimensional causal set quantum gravity, and how, in particular, in this particular class of models, you can get the continuum emerging in a very definite sense of that word. And I'll talk about some of the open questions that we need to address as well. So, let me just remind you of the basic causal set hypothesis. It's based on two fundamental building blocks. One is the existence in a causal spacetime of a causal structure poset. It's a partially ordered set, which means that it satisfies these three properties of the order relation satisfies these three properties. And every Lorentzian spacetime has this causal set poset in it. Every causal Lorentzian spacetime has this causal set poset, causal structure poset. A spacetime that is not Lorentzian, so even if you had a signature minus, minus, plus, plus, does not have this poset. So this is very, very characteristic of Lorentzian spacetime. It's absent, of course, in Riemannian spacetimes, and this is one of the fundamental building blocks of causal set theory. The second building block is the assumption of a fundamental spacetime discreteness, which is that for every spacetime volume here, of finite volume contains a finite number of elements, fundamental spacetime elements, fundamental elements of the causal structure poset. And this is one of my favorite quotes from Mark Katz, which is, "BY is discretized," which is very appropriate for this session. So the postulate, the hypothesis of causal set theory, is that the underlying structure of spacetime is a locally finite, partially ordered set. The local finiteness captures the fact that you have a finite number of elements, spacetime atoms, for a finite spacetime volume. Okay. Where does this come from? It's motivated, Faye talked about this a little, it's motivated by a very deep theorem from Lorentzian geometry, which tells you that the causal structure plus the local volume element is sufficient to give you the full spacetime geometry. So in other words, the causal structure contains a huge amount of information about the Lorentzian spacetime. So what we're doing here in causal sets is to say, well, take that partial order, take the causal order, replace it by a partial order, and that's so causal structure goes to order. Spacetime volume is replaced by number. So that missing ingredient of the conformal factor or the local volume element is given by the postulate of finiteness, of discreteness. And so you have the slogan due to Raphael Sorkin that order plus number is approximately going to give you spacetime geometry. So how do we recover spacetime from causal sets? That wiggly line is supposed to indicate that you only want to do so in an approximate sense. We're not interested in the continuum limit. We're only interested in a continuum approximation. And importantly, if you're going to look at a spacetime and say, what is the underlying causal set? If you did try to do a regular discretization, you wouldn't preserve the number to volume correspondence, which is crucial to the hypothesis. And instead, therefore, you need to look at a random lattice generated by a Poisson distribution, and this is supposed to represent, without the links, which Faye showed you this morning, a causal set which is underlying a piece of Minkowski spacetime, two-dimensional Minkowski spacetime. Okay, so I hope this is enough of a short introduction, and the key points are clear. So what one would like to do with causal sets, because now we've replaced spacetime with these locally finite partially ordered sets. And so you want to ask, well, how do you do a quantum theory of gravity with these objects? And there is, I want to mention this because this is kind of, I think, very crucial to the way we think, is that there are ways of thinking about how to do this from first principles. The idea of trying to construct a quantum sequential growth dynamics, where you're from first principles, you ask, how do you create a causal set out of nothing? And the formulation that seems most beautifully suited to this question, although it's extremely hard to tackle, is the quantum measure formulation. But for this talk, I'm going to pretend that we're not even thinking about on those lines. We're just going to think about the way people normally think about constructing a path integral in quantum gravity, which is to write down a partition function. So what you want to do is you want to sum over some sample space of causal sets. That's my omega. And you have a causal set action, which could, for example, be the Benincasa-Dauker action, which Faye talked about this morning. What is the sample space of causal sets? One natural thing you might want to do in causal set theory is to fix the number of elements in the causal set. And then perhaps in an appropriate sense, take that limit to infinity. So it's a sort of unimodular quantum gravity. But if I look at the class of causal sets in the large n limit, just the space of all possible causal sets, then as Faye mentioned again today, that basically this space is dominated by things that look completely unlike spacetime. There's a huge entropic contribution coming from these so-called Kleitman-Rothschild causal sets, which are these three-level causal sets. So it seems like you have a lot of work to do. The space is actually richer than this. It has, in a sense of the microcanonical ensemble, there's an infinite sequence of first-order phase transitions, and there are that were discovered by Deepak Dhar, where the space of causal sets has a very, very rich structure. And in that paper, there were some very important comparisons that I want to point out that he made to lattice gas models with long-range interactions. And this sort of gives us a hint as to how to deal with causal sets as a distinct theory of quantum gravity. So the causal set action in n dimensions has got this approximate form. And importantly, you have these, so n is a number of elements, and the ni are the number of I element order intervals. That means you're counting the number of links in the causal sets, the abundance of links, the abundance of two chains, okay, and the abundance of three element intervals, and so on and so forth. And they appear in this very nice form in the action. And those are the things you have to count in order to calculate the action. OK, so if you want to set up a continuum-inspired dynamics, then you basically want to make a choice of omega. You want to make a choice of the action, what dimension you're going to choose. But now you want to evaluate this. And what we would like to do is to put this on the computer, as people do in CDTs and in other approaches. But what is the Euclidean analog of a causal set? There's none. As I said, the partially ordered set is something very special to a Lorentzian spacetime. There's no Euclidean analog of a causal set. So we have to do something else. We have to do what has been suggested in the past, is to look at doing a different kind of analytic continuation. Consider the fact that you have a complex function and there's ways to analytically continue it. One way which I will adopt here is to introduce a new parameter, which is like a fake inverse temperature, beta. And I take put beta in front of my action and take I beta going to beta, or minus beta. So importantly, in this process of analytic continuation, what I've got, I've gone from quantum theory to a statistical theory, but I haven't changed my configuration space. And this, to me, is a very important point, which I'd like to emphasize, because if I want to construct observables, they're still going to be Lorentzian observables. Okay, so I'm going to describe in the remaining time this particular model of 2D causal set theory. And here what I do is I restrict my sample space. So one option, even after fixing n, is to take the set of all possible causal sets. And we've started to look at this case. It's a very, very difficult problem, trying to construct and do Monte Carlo moves on this. So the simpler question is to now say, well, let's just restrict from omega to a smaller sample space. And what's the simplest thing you can think of is something that mimics two-dimensional spacetime. And so the things called 2D orders, I'll describe them in a minute. And we use the 2D Benincasa-Dow correction. Importantly, the class that we're going to look at are things that are conformally flat. So they're just topologically trivial, equivalent of topologically trivial spacetimes that you want to sum over. This is sort of the first step, so to speak. So what is a 2D order? It's a pair of two total orders. I'll call them suggestively U and V, like the two null directions in your two-dimensional spacetime. And a 2D order is constructed out of two linear total orders on the same set of n elements by taking an intersection of them. So for example, if you have the two linear orders, U and V, in this way, if you switch them around in U and V, then those two points are space-like related. Okay? So they're time-like related if they have the same order relation in both linear orders. But if they're switched around in one of them, then they're space-like related. So it's a very simple okay. So, all right, so these are examples of 2D orders. Many of them look very non-space-like, even though I'm sort of taken my inspiration from two-dimensional space-time. Importantly, there's a analytic result, a maths result, which says that if you look at this uniform distribution on 2D orders, this particular sample space, then it's dominated by these things called 2D random orders, which in fact are just flat spacetime. Okay, so without putting any action, this spacetime, this class of causal sets already has this really nice property that is dominated by flat things that look like flat spacetime. Importantly, I want to just emphasize that we have a parameter in our theory, Faye talked about it a little, which is the non-locality scale epsilon. And that will feature in the action because you have a whole class of actions depending on the scale, non-locality scale that you choose. So we perform this particular Monte Carlo move. It's a very simple move because we have a very simple class of causal sets. It's very similar to things you would do in Ising type models. And this is sort of what you would do, is you'd flip around a pair in any one given total order, etc. So we track covariant observables. We do the Monte Carlo simulations for these. The covariant observables that we track in our simulations is something called an ordering fraction, which is a number of relations versus the number of total possible relations that you could have. And this is a totally label-invariant way of talking about it. Importantly, in causal sets, covariance corresponds to label-invariance. Okay. So all of these various observables, like dimension, the action, as well as the abundance of these order intervals that Faye talked about, just the number of them is already an observable. It's something that's label-independent. It's characteristic of the causal set, and so on and so forth. And when you do that, what we found is the existence of, as you vary beta, you find a crossover phase transition. We're not yet sure what to call it yet, which is very characteristic. I'm just going to go through this very quickly. So all of the observables satisfy this. And you can ask, well, what does this phase transition correspond to? If you take a typical ensemble, realization in this ensemble, one of the ensembles, and you look at it in the phase, in the first, before the phase transition as beta is increasing, the phase that you see looks exactly like a random 2D order. Now, these are simulations we've done with just 50 elements, okay? So I'm sure that everyone's going to be laughing privately, but the fact of the matter is that you can get out a lot of continuum information because N is not the only thing that counts in a causal set. It's also the number of relations, and that's really important to remember. Okay, so it's not just the number of elements, but also the fact that there's a huge richness of structure in the causal set. So here, I'm sorry, but this should be seen as a space-time where you have to tilt your head. Okay, the light cones are this way, and that's your flat space-time. And so you have an entire phase, which is a flat space-time phase, and if you compare all these observables and the expectation values, they fit flat space-time very beautifully. And this is just an example of that. The second phase is extremely weird. It's completely unexpected. It has this character of, again, a three-layer thing, but it's not one of the Chiarpo sets because it lies outside of that class, and it's highly non-manifold-like because you can't think of it as a random, as obtained from a random Poisson sprinkling. And again, when you compare, you can find that it has very different characteristics from flat space-time. So what does this mean? Of course, we've got a phase transition and so on with this simple model. What does it mean? So importantly, the fact that we have something for finite beta, which is flat space-time, already is interesting because we're not really interested in the continuum limit, we're only interested in the continuum approximation. So we already get flat space-time out of this. It's emergent in this sense. But of course, we're doing this all in the thermodynamic limit, and how do we even begin to understand what it means with the analytic continuation? And here's a diagram that I've plotted, which Faye showed, but it's beta squared. I've just plotted beta squared because beta squared negative is an analytically continued region, and beta squared positive is what we've calculated. And this is the string of, or the line of phase transitions. And the phase one is a continuum phase. Phase two is this crystalline phase. And if you think of it, if you sort of make assumptions about analyticity and so on, you can see that there's a possibility that the phase one, the continuum phase, actually survives some sort of analytic continuation. There are other issues to consider, but I'll just leave the slide like this right now.
So would you eventually go back to beta versus high beta?
Yeah, so that
if you do, then the interpretation will be transition amplitude?
No, so it isn't quite the same sort of thing that you do for T going to I tau, right? Because there's no time here. This is an analytic continuation of the functional, which is the amplitude itself. So you're analytically continuing the amplitude, so that, that particular interpretation would not be there. The amplitude is four spacetimes that are, which have this sort of, I mean, it's, so yeah, so the question of whether it's a transition amplitude or not, it's not a transition amplitude, except perhaps from the vacuum back to the vacuum. But it's not, in principle, a transition amplitude. It's just a partition function, and we're calculating the expectation value of observables in this.
Do you have a, I went by too fast. Do you have a plot of the ordering fraction as
yes.
you go through the transition?
Yes.
And can you tell me which one is, which phase is which?
Yeah. So this is, of course, very blown up. I should have got one from 0 to 1. So the ordering fraction is from 0 to 1. So that one here is, this here is the flat spacetime. So ordering fraction, inverse of the ordering fraction is the spacetime dimension.
So the complexity, the somehow the complexity of the number of connections is higher in the crystalline phase?
Pardon the?
The number of links is higher, the relative number.
The number of relations, but not the number of links. Well, so it's the so here, so let me just quickly show you the plot here. This sort of gives you how links and, you know, two chains and so on change, and they really, the profile is very different from that of flat spacetime. Sure.
I didn't forget to put this on phase action because I don't know. Is it supposed to be equivalent somehow to the Einstein equation?
Yes. Einstein-Hilbert action, right. So that's sort of the analog of the Reggie action you might want to use for causal sets.
Right. So let's thank her so much.
Very well. Let me begin by thanking the organizers for this opportunity and also to you for pronouncing my name correctly. Thank you very much. It's not working. Oops. Almost looks like if the audience doesn't behave, then it can be used. okay, this is part of the motivation. In general, one expects that in quantum theory of gravity, the space-time symmetry is particularly, usually one talks about Lorentz symmetry, is potentially violated. This is an expectation which is partly based on the statement that quantum gravity comes with its scale, namely Planck scale. An existence of a fundamental scale is considered to be indicative of violation of Lorentz symmetry. This is understood at least intuitively in the context of as though the spacetime has a discrete lattice-like structure. Whereas now LQG also reveals a discreteness but of a different type. There is no manifold which it discretizes, only the metrical properties which are such that geometrical quantities are discrete spectra. So the question that I would like to explore is, does the metrical discreteness suggest violation of continuous symmetries? Now the reason for this metrical discreteness in LQG is also specifically related to a particular quantization, particular non-separable Hilbert space which is there. So I will change the question and ask it, are certain quantization in conflict with implementation of continuous symmetries? Now, given a quantization, it is possible that I can always add terms and add interactions which will violate a particular symmetry, but that is not the question that I am asking. I am asking that, do I have a quantization where it is, in some sense, almost impossible to implement a continuous symmetry? If so, in what sense, and if not, what not? That is what I want to explore. Now, Lorentz symmetry is more complicated, So I'm going to explore it for the case of rotational symmetry in the context of two systems, which is polymer quantum mechanics and polymer quantized scalar field theory. This is work done with my student, which is the reference is given. So here is the plan. I will first just recall very quickly realization of symmetries in standard Schrodinger quantum mechanics, just to remind you. Realization of symmetries in polymer quantum mechanics, then the dual option, that is to say, instead of talking about symmetries and group actions in the Hilbert space you start with, go to the dual space. Realization of symmetries in polymer quantized scalar field, and then few remarks about it. Okay, so Schrodinger quantum mechanics, as everybody knows, this is just to quickly have the notation so that I will use the same notation in the next slide. So you start with, I'm looking at three-dimensional quantum mechanics, so particle moving in three dimensions. So basic observables are three coordinates qi and conjugate moment of pi. The states are going to be labeled by three vectors, k and k prime, and their inner products is typically delta function. These are taken to be eigenstates of pi, this is just a choice. And whereas the qi's will act by derivatives with respect to ki, the standard one. The rotations are of course defined by these lambda matrices, and the action of rotations on the basic observables is defined here. Typically any symmetry action will go by ua u dagger, and you simply specify that transform quantity is this linear combination, and similarly for the p's. Now infinitesimally of course I can talk about rotations which are just identity plus epsilon, lower index will be antisymmetric. Corresponding unitary operators will be defined this infinitesimal generators. And then from using this equation, one can deduce what should be the form of these generators J's. So this is something which is specified the moment I specify what kind of transformations I'm talking about. This is the usual quantum mechanics. I'm going to repeat the same thing, but now for polymer quantum mechanics, the changes are that basic observables are going to be not QIs, but e to the I K vector dot Q vector. And PIs. PIs remain as they are, whereas the positions are now changing to exponentials. So states are now going to be labeled by same k vector and k vector prime, but instead of delta function, there is Kronecker delta, so they are properly normalized. And since they take infinitely many values, the orthonormal set, which is uncountable, and therefore the space is non-separable, they are again eigenvalues of the p operators, and the exponentials will act simply by adding this, because in that sense, exponentials are multiplicative operators. Once again, the action of the rotations is specified in a completely obvious manner, the standard fashion, whatever we did normally before. But now it is going to act on this, and from this equation and the fact that this is the eigenvalue, we can deduce that u lambda acting on k is simply going to change the k label by the lambda inverse. Okay. Can notice that choose any positive number sigma. Then under this action of the rotations, since I'm only going to change the k vector to another k vector, its norm is going to be preserved. So for every k square equal to sigma, I'm going to get a set of k's which are the orbit of the action of the group. And since each one of these states is orthonormal, it's an orthonormal set, what I get is an infinite dimensional irreducible representation of rotation group. Okay. This may appear as a surprise that how come rotation groups have unitary representations which are infinite dimensional. The distinctive point is that these are non-continuous representations. So there is no notion of Lie algebra for this, but only action of the group. And that is the reason why one can have such a thing. And although one can quote theorems, in this case, I don't need to do that. It's simply explicitly clear that I have constructed a representation of that form. So one can now ask the question, fine, you have specified the action of the symmetry. Action of a group on the state space. Can I get this action to be symmetries? That is, do I have a dynamics which is invariant under this? So what are the possible invariants? Of course, I can talk about p square, p dot p. I cannot use q because q is not my basic operator. So only e to the iq is which basic operator. So q dot q is not available to me, so I can't write harmonic oscillator. However, although p dot q cannot be written, I can still talk about this exponential of p dot q. This is something which comes in LQC. One uses in the improved quantization approach. One can talk about the exponentials of the connection, which can still be multiplied by the triad in that case. So multiplied by p vector here, this will still generate diffeomorphisms which are can be implemented unitarily. And one can calculate what that is. I can give the the details afterwards. Just take it right now that so. This kind of objects can be defined properly on this Hilbert space, and action is specifically given on the basis, It just scales the k vector by certain amount. The amount is specified by how much is the diffeomorphism shifting by the amount 1. So this depends on what f I choose. I can choose f to be just 1, in which case this scaling will be simply the exponential e, the base e of the natural log. However, once we get that, so now we can construct non-trivial Hamiltonians, not just the free Hamiltonian which will be p square, but now typically eigenvalues of such an invariant Hamiltonian. So I've got a symmetry now, which is rotations, representations which is unitary, but it's discontinuous representation, and eigenvalues of such Hamiltonian are generically infinitely degenerate. So although I can implement the rotations as a unitary symmetry, it is physically unacceptable because I'm going to get, for possible invariant Hamiltonians, typical eigenvalues will be infinitely degenerate. So this is not an acceptable, physically acceptable conclusion. So either rotation ceases to be a symmetry. So this can happen either by explicit breaking. So I just don't allow such term, I just add additional terms, in which case I don't have to worry about that. I can still have group action which is non-trivial, that I don't care. However, that is not a symmetry, so I don't have to worry about it. So, or I can say that the symmetry is spontaneously broken, and this is simply by saying that I can select a set of e to the I k's that I've chosen. So choose a subset of this, finitely many, and then start with a given k and generate all possible polynomials in these observables. Declare that to be your complete set of observables, and then that is going to act on the subspace generated from a given k. That subspace is your superselection sector by definition. Now that is not going to be left invariant under the action of the group. Therefore, what you have is, although the group action commutes with the Hamiltonian, I can still choose the same Hamiltonian. So it is a symmetry, but it is not going to select, preserve my superselection sector, and therefore it's spontaneously broken. So the conclusion, therefore, is that it is possible to have continuous symmetries implemented unitarily. However, the consequence of that is infinite degeneracy, which is not acceptable. Therefore, symmetry must be either explicitly broken or spontaneously broken. Okay, so one problem for this has happened, of course, because of the fact that the representation is continuous. I don't have corresponding Lie algebra, so all the normal intuition that I have about representation theory is simply gone. But one can do something else. So there are two things. I can either consider the approximations of e to the ik dot q, so define the corresponding operators q's which are approximated. So it is e to the ik dot q minus e to the minus ik dot q divided by delta. Don't take the limit delta going to 0. So I can use those operators, in which case I am breaking the possibility of rotations explicitly, and the amount of breaking is controlled by this parameter delta. So I can do that. That's one option, which has already been done by Davi Chu a couple of years back. Here I'm going to look at a different option, namely find my original polymorph Hilbert space I started with is not giving me what I thought it should give me. So I can go to something else. I can go to the dual, which means I consider the algebraic dual, that is consider set of the, so my consider the finite linear combinations of e to the ik dot q that I took. So finitely many of them, that defines my space of cylindrical functions. Take its algebraic dual, that is sil star, and then the elements of that are going to act on the basis vectors simply by, and going to produce for me some functions psi of k. Okay, so this is just the action of the duals. Now, given any operator on the sil to sil, I can consider its dual from sil star to sil star by the obvious dual action definition. It's completely standard. So using this action of this, I can therefore take the u lambda, which is defined for all of sil. I can take its action on the sil star to get define u tilde. And then from this, I can calculate this quantity. Okay. Now, on the sil, I did not have the limit of this because the representation was discontinuous. So this would not work in sil, but I am now acting on, this is not a matrix element, but it is action of the distribution onto this. And then straightforward calculation will simply tell you that this can be approximated in this way. So provided I restrict myself to the psi's which are defined here, so for every choice of psi of k, I'm going to get a corresponding distribution. Okay? So now I restrict myself to only those psi's which are differentiable. And if so, then I can talk about this. And then this action exactly same as this defines for me what my infinitesimal generator is. One can check that from this definition, it will satisfy the usual algebra of rotations. So I can recover the infinitesimal symmetries in the sil star. since it is defined only on the subspace of SIL star, I cannot use the I cannot use the dual action back to go back to SIL. I should not be able to do so, and that is the case. Okay, one can also define, I did not mention it, I mean just mention in passing, that e to the I k dot q is defined, but q is not defined. However, I can define the corresponding operator on SIL star again. By the same thing, I start with the object which is defined on the SIL, pull it onto the SIL star, the dual space, and in there I can take the limit provided again, I restrict myself to psi stars which are differentiable functions. So I can recover everything there. One can recover, introduce appropriate inner product, I can tell you privately afterwards, and also get recover the standard Schrodinger quantization. So that looks like a complicated way of getting Schrodinger quantization, but the purpose is not so much to reproduce Schrodinger quantization, but to understand that if I started with polymer representation, if I find it unacceptable, what else can I do? And I can recover it by going to the SIL. Now, very quickly, I will go through the polymer quantized scalar field. The method is exactly identical, logic is exactly identical, only some details are going to change. So here my states are going to be, you choose a set of n points, so I'm looking at now a scalar field, which is going to be quantized the polymer way. So I choose n points, distinct points in three-dimensional space. I choose a set of n non-zero lambdas. And for each of these, I construct a quantity of this form. So set of all these finite linear combinations of these are going to span a space, which is going to be called a SIL. And notationally, it's convenient to denote simply in this fashion. V is the set of all the vertices, the points I have chosen, and lambda is the corresponding weights. The smeared moment are defined in the standard way, no change here, it's exactly what it is. And then these states which are chosen happen to be eigenstates of this smeared momentum, and the action is again, as one would expect, completely normal action. There's nothing funny here. The point holonorm is the states that I wrote earlier, these objects. These, however, are going to act on these states as multiplication, and then there is some small subtlety that if I take an object phi of x, this V set does not contain that, then there are three options. If the set is completely different, then I simply get another set with another lambda. So I get a new basis state. If the x coincides with one of the vertices, and but this is non-zero, then I simply get this object is changed. If it is zero, then this argument is deleted because the basis labels are simply such that x's have to be distinct and the corresponding lambdas have to be non-zero. On this, rotations act by simply changing the vertex set and doesn't change the lambdas. The inner product on this, which is defined, namely v lambda prime, simply is basically Kronecker data. So it is non-zero only if the vertices match exactly and corresponding lambdas also match. Otherwise, it is zero. So the action here is going to be simply, this one can calculate. So under rotations, this only the points are going to be changed. Lambdas don't change, therefore the action is unitary. The action on the smeared momenta is again simply by changing the lambda inverse action on the G smearing function. Now, again, all the points I mentioned about the discontinuous representation polymer quantum case are exactly same also in this case. It's essentially same logic. So I will again try to go to the dual space and see how I can recover both the infinitesimal action of the group as well as the definition of phi, which I did not have because I have only e to the phi, but now I can recover the definition of phi as well. So logic is similar again. So what I have is the distribution, which is, I specify the distribution by giving a functions of x1, x2, xn, and lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda n. All of these are distinct, that is crucial. So if I give that, then I specify the distribution. So now I just, again, try to calculate the same way that I know the action of the rotations group on the SIL. I get a dual action, try to take the limit, and in that process I discover I can do so provided these sides are chosen to be differentiable functions. Okay? So those differentiable functions for the, just a couple of minutes. As far as infinitesimal generators are concerned, I need the differentiability of psi with respect to the x1, x2, xn. However, if I want to define the smeared scalar field operators, then I need the differentiability with respect to lambdas and the condition that the first derivative at must be zero. This has to do with the fact that the action of when I take the e to the I phi, phi x is there. Remember, the multiplicative action is non-trivial. It depends whether the given vertex matches with the basis vectors or not. And if I want the action to produce again the element of the SIL star that I choose, then I must put this restriction that the action is non-trivial only if the argument x coincides with one of the vertices. And that requires this condition to be true. Just two more slides and I'm through. So this then leads to the definition. The J's will act exactly as one would expect. So there is no surprise there. Whereas the scalar field phi that I can define now, the smear field now, which again has only finitely many terms here. So that, and this is coming from that condition I wrote on the previous transparency. It involves the derivative with respect to lambda and the smearing functions, but it is something which is at finitely many points. Now from these definitions, one can check immediately that the smeared commutator of this will correspond to what we would expect in the standard Schrodinger quantized scalar field. The J's will also act as expected. They will act like rotations. So all the usual results can be recovered by going to Silstar. This of course is only, only specified the conditions on the subspace of Silstar. I need to put an inner product on that and then make a new Hilbert space out of it. And that is the Hilbert space on which I would have recovered my continuous representations as well as smeared operators and so on. So since I'm almost running out, this is my last transparency. So just to conclude, so continuous symmetries can be implemented in polymer quantization, but with physically unacceptable price of infinitely degenerate energies. Therefore, this must be broken explicitly otherwise. So this is a case in which the quantization is telling you that I cannot handle on physical, I cannot handle symmetries which will give you physically viable results. Okay. Alternatively, you take it as an intermediate step and say that fine, this is my auxiliary step in between. I should go to really Silstar and then repeat the analysis there, and there I can recover various things. Now, in the case of LQG, this is anyway needed because it's a constraint theory. So you start with kinematical Hilbert space, which is analog of this polymer one that I started with. But then you have to look for solutions in Silstar anyway. So that is the reason there. But here, of course, the reason is very different. So I think with this, I will conclude. Thank you. Another fast pattern.
How did you get rid of the infinite degeneracy? Was it just by restricting yourself to a subspace?
Yeah. So I have to simply say that I have to consider I have to choose Hamiltonians either which violate the symmetry explicitly, or I have to restrict to super selection sector, which will be separable and so on, because I look at only countable ones.
So super selection with respect to what? Set of observables.
That I have to choose. I have to select a subset of e to the ik dot q. So I take from them, say, finitely many of those, multiply by delta. So I'll get a finitely many objects, generate the algebra from that. And whatever it acts on a given k, that will generate a subspace. And that's my super selection sector by definition.
Also, I didn't understand the intended, if there is an intended application. I could have asked the same question to Florian again, why I invited you.
What is the
application? Is there a discreteness here? And also, is there an
generalization actually discrete and mixed?
And mixed, right? Yes.
There is not only discrete.
Yeah, in fact, No, the discreteness here refers to metrical discreteness. Okay. I mentioned that it is not discreteness of the manifold. That is coming from LQG part.
In general, when you have a polymer quantization, like you can have, from what I understand, you can choose momenta, you can have positions acting on, but if you choose momenta to affect the difference of two of these translational operators.
So if you restrict to the super selection sector, that will correspond to, as though I have generated something like a discrete set of states. That's correct. So that is one way I will do that. That's correct. So there is a translation that one needs a rotation, which is more complicated. And in terms of application, the reason I did this was basically to say that people talk about Lorentz violation, etc. Now, I don't quite understand which Lorentz violation group one is talking about. What is violated is only dispersion relation, certainly not local Lorentz invariance under triad formulation. Is it the set of local inertial frames with respect to which you are checking? What exactly one is checking? So the question to understand violation, I first like to see how do you construct a framework in which symmetry is exact, and then I say this is violation is parameterized in this fashion. So first question is, can I implement symmetry in that? And since Lorentz is more complicated, I looked at rotations first. But it is nevertheless it's continuous, and then you see what other problems come that just came as an accident. So that was the motivation for us. The real thing is to go to the Lorentz violation.